A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 3, Institutions. What made the Spartans so different?
Our focus in this lecture is going to be on institutions broadly considered. What were the characteristics that made the Spartans so different from the perspectives not only of other non-Hellenic cultures, but also even from the perspective of the Greeks? Well, first of all, of course, there's this full-scale devotion to duty, to courage, to discipline, this full-scale institutionalized commitment to the welfare of the state, which involves, by virtue of its military focus, a kind of institutionalized training with regard to how to confront death. It would not be true, I don't think, to say that the Spartans were a culture of death, but they were definitely a culture that placed a high premium on dealing with death, confronting death, overcoming fear of death, making the prospect of death as little disruptive and diminishing as it possibly could be. That's, of course, part and parcel of the focus on militarization, though it extends beyond that. And that focus on militarization contributes in its way, or derives in its way, from four other major factors that I'd like to devote the rest of the lecture to examining. In the first case, the Helots and the dependence of the Spartan elite on the Helots. In the second place, the Spartan army itself. In the third place, the upbringing or agoge, which prepared people, men in particular, to be full members of the Spartan army and citizens. There was no distinction. Members of the army were citizens. Citizens were members of the army unless they had aged out. And finally, the syssitia, or messes, in which all citizens were expected to eat their evening meal, effectively lifelong. Helots first, and in more senses than one. They were basically slaves of the state. All Greek poleis, all Greek polises, held slaves, or people in all Greek polises, poleis, held slaves. Not least the Athenians, a substantial part of whose revenue came from the state silver mines, where slaves worked in really appalling conditions. But Sparta was different from other Greek states, and the Helots were different from other Greek slaves in several senses. In the first case, the Spartans vastly outnumbered Spartan citizens and citizen families by at least 10 to 1 and probably more like 20 to 1 and by a greater margin increasingly as time went on. That's a disproportion radically unlike the disproportion which obtained in any other Greek state. There were lots more Helots or slaves and lots fewer citizens than elsewhere. Second, and this really did upset other Greeks a lot. Characteristically, Greek slaves were captives or the descendants of captives in war, and they were generally speaking not ethnically Greek. increasingly Greek in a cultural sense, no doubt just from proximity as time passed, but they were not ethnically Greek. The Helots were ethnically Greek as the Spartans, and other Greeks found that very upsetting. First, whether when the Dorians came or whatever happened, the Spartan elite conquered the other folks who were living in Laconia. Specifically, the richest part of Laconia, which is near the mouth of the Eurotas River and which is called the Helos Plain. Some people have thought that the name Helots comes, in fact, from the Helos Plain, but evidently that's not the case. It evidently comes from a root word meaning something like capture. So Helots are the captured ones, which would be in accordance with Greek norms, as a matter of fact, the difference being that the captured Helots were not members of another culture, but were in fact Greeks. Then, and under, by all appearances, harsher terms, the Spartans managed to conquer neighboring Messenia, and they made Helots of the Messenians, who seem to have felt more harshly antagonistic towards the Spartans themselves than the Laconian Helots did, by and large. The Spartans also made efforts to move not to the west, but to the mountainous north, into the central Peloponnese, and to make Helots of folks in Arcadia, but for a variety of reasons, that didn't work out. And as the Spartans later on expanded their power, they did so not through full-scale conquest of adjoining region and consequent Helotization of the inhabitants, but rather they did so with a formulation of a series of unequal treaties with adjoining polities, which gave rise ultimately to the Peloponnesian League, which was, of course, dominated by Sparta. The Helots differed from regular slaves in another sense, in that they had some kind of enduring tie to their land. They could marry and they could own property. They also were, generally speaking, not the property of any specific individual. They were tied to the land, which was ultimately owned by the state. So in several respects, Helotry was different. Nevertheless, it was in no sense an enviable position. And the Spartans went out of their way to enforce the sense of difference between themselves and the Helots. They made the Helots wear what they regarded as demeaning clothing, dogskin caps, and so forth. To demonstrate what a bad idea it was to get drunk, they would bring Helots to the communal messes and make them get stinking drunk and then mock them to show the boys who were at the mess what a bad idea it was to let things get out of hand. They beat them regularly. Regular slaves weren't subjected to that sort of thing plenty. More disturbing is the fact that at least in later times, especially after a very costly earthquake in Sparta, which led to massive Helot revolt, a sort of Spartan secret service called the Cryptia, and it means pretty close to secret service, composed for the most part of 20-year-olds just finishing up their education, would be sent off with just a knife, no provisions, nowhere to live, into the countryside where their job was to learn to be independent and fend for themselves by stealing, but also to murder any Helots who looked like they might be powerful or prominent or a source of trouble in the future. And that is the most damaging and unsavory thing that I know of that went on at Sparta. To validate that, or in any case, to prevent ritual defilement by that, the ephors of Sparta, high magistrates who we'll talk about in a bit in a subsequent lecture, annually declared war on the Helots as a whole, so that killing a Helot would be a military action and not manslaughter or murder. The Helots, as you might imagine, though this varied from their position, Messenians more than Laconians, and the nature of the work that they were expected to do, but by and large had perfectly understandable sense of hostility towards the Spartans themselves. And as I suggested in an earlier lecture, most authorities think that the militarization of Sparta was in fact a function of Sparta's perceived need to keep the Helots in line and under control. Which leads us to the Spartan army. The state as a whole was designed, of course, above all to support the Spartan army, which in turn preserved the state. And the first step in that process is that Spartan citizens, Spartan soldiers, were expected to perform, and indeed forbidden from performing, any productive labor at all. All they did was train for war. Their wants, their physical wants, were supplied by various clairoi, as they called them, plots of land farmed by Helots who gave a stated portion, supposedly about half of their produce, to support their Spartan overlords. This throughout the region. So the Spartan citizens, in the usual sense of the term, did no work at all. There were other folks who were not Helots, and a good many of them, as a matter of fact, in a sort of intermediate state. They were called the perioiki, which means the people who were living around, the dwellers around. They were not enslaved, but were not full citizens either, and rather than agricultural labor and sort of personal household service and the like, they were craftspeople, by and large, who performed those functions for the Spartan state. But the Spartans themselves were forbidden to work at any craft, to do any agricultural labor. Their wives, Spartan women, did no housework. That was entirely handled by Helots. They had Helot nursemaids and so on. Working? No. You devoted all of your time to training as hoplite heavy infantry. An all hoplite, full time citizen army supported by Helots and Perioiki. They would ordinarily go into battle, as a matter of fact, with each Spartan citizen having a Helot retainer, to use the British term Batman, whose job it was to carry his armor before he got to battle and to cook for him and so forth. Sometimes more than one, but always with this array of retainers going with them. Well, as you might imagine, training full-time from age 7 to age 60, which they did, the Spartans got very, very, very good at heavy infantry hoplite warfare tactics, and could perform maneuvers on the battlefield and maintain cohesion on the battlefield in a way that for centuries nobody else could match and nobody else came particularly close even to matching. Again, they marched slow into battle in perfect formation, could do complicated maneuvers. Their flute players, alloy players, which is a little peculiar. Flutes is a misleading term. What they really sound like is more like bagpipes, and bagpipes going into battle is a sort of more familiar notion if you think of Highland regiments. In all of these ways, totally professional. They would supposedly, bring their spears in together in unison, the whole performance being as imposing as possible. They also had uniforms, which, at least in later times, which was not characteristic to the same degree, certainly, of other Greek poleis. Their aspis calce, their bronze shield, ordinarily had a lambda on it for the first letter in the name of the region, not Sparta itself, but Lacedaemon. So they would all have this, it looks like an upside-down V on their shields. They also, from the time they gained adulthood and became citizens, wore what they called the stole phoenicus, which is the red cloak, dyed with what is in effect Tyrian purple, so a kind of crimson robe. Their dress was distinctive in other ways as well. They did not wear mustaches, but from the time they became adults, they let their hair grow and ordinarily had very long, shoulder length and more, braided hair, and also let their beard grow with no mustache. This is not, by the way, if you see, you know, contemporary sports teams who adopt Spartans as mascots, they don't look authentic, because the real ones, as you can see from figurines which they themselves made, did have very, very long braided hair, which they cared for very, very carefully. In fact, at Thermopylae, Xerxes' scout saw them preparing their hair before battle and was rather undone by it. Didn't know what to make of this odd behavior. The traditional story was that long hair made a handsome man look better and a ugly man look scarier. So it was a good idea in either case. They also had from childhood been customarily going barefoot, which is pretty formidable thing to do in Greece, which has lots of prickly weeds, but they evidently got used to that early on and they felt that they had better footing, in battle with their naked feet on the ground. Sometimes, at least, this is a little hard for me to believe, on the basis of their figurines, they went into battle not wearing any pants, which is, kind of an alarming thought, but there you have it. They had a cultural disdain as heavy-armored, close-in infantry fighters for slingers and archers. They thought of those as cowardly weapons where you don't have to engage, which didn't prevent them, as time went on, to hiring people or employing people as slingers and archers. But they didn't think that that sort of fighting was really a man's work. And also, unsurprisingly, though the exact pattern seems to have varied over time, this is hard to tell because the Spartans were not big on keeping records and not big either on letting outsiders into their secrets, but their army was clearly oriented into something like battalions and divisions, which were capable of operating as units. And in that, too, they were ahead of the curve so far as their competitors were concerned. They had on active service each age class, all the people who had gone through the agoge together, functioning in some sense as a unit on its own, all the 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, all the way up to all the 59-year-olds and 60-year-olds. And depending on who they were fighting and how serious the threat was, they would call up a various number of age groups. Never that I can recall all of them at once, but sometimes as much as three quarters, maybe on occasion, but not that I can think of offhand. And of course, by preference, they would call up the younger ones earlier and more frequently so that as you began to age out, you would be employed in the front lines less often, which does make sense. They also had an elite group of 300 from the younger age classes who were called hippies. Technically cavalrymen, though the Spartans didn't think much of cavalry either. They were really more like elite infantrymen and served as the king's bodyguard. And as time went on, and as the number of Spartan citizens began to decline. In the Spartan heyday, it seems to have declined from about 8,000 down to not much more than 1,000 for a variety of reasons, which we'll explore later. But more and more, the Spartan army would include as an elite full Spartan citizens, but then often perioeci, who had been at least semi-trained by Spartans fighting in the Spartan line as well, and ultimately, starting in the 420s, neo-domodois, as they called them, basically new citizens who were helots, who were enrolled in the army and were given their freedom of a not full citizenship, but their freedom as a result of that. So as time went on, more and more the actual full Spartans, few in number as they were, became in effect officers. Actually, the Spartan social system was filled with gradations, very, very hierarchical. At the top were the Spartiatai, or homoioi meaning the similars, the equals, the guys who were all alike. And those were the people who were full Spartan citizens and had gone through the full agoge and been accepted into a mess. They were the top echelon. But then there were also people who were called mothakes. The singular is mothax, who had been accepted into the agoge, even though both of their parents weren't full Spartan citizens, most often a Spartan father and a helot mother. In fact, I presume probably exclusively that. And some of those guys went on to become very, very prominent indeed. Probably the most prominent of them was Lysander, who was the victor in the final battle of the Peloponnesian War. And another very prominent mothax was Gylippus, who led the defense of Syracuse against Athens. So you could rise a long way there. Then there were Nothoi, who were, again, mixed helot and Spartan parentage. No more details than that. Trophimoi, who were people who had gone through the agoge who weren't Spartans later on, foreigners. Xenophon, for instance, sent his own children to Sparta to take part in the Spartan upbringing in sort of a prep school sense. And then there were hypomenois, who were Spartans who didn't have enough property to make the necessary contribution to the mess, so they were Spartans who were not full Spartan citizens, or else they were people who were once Spartan citizens but had been knocked out of the citizen roles for bad behavior or cowardice of one sort or another. So above the perioeci and helots, you have this whole spectrum of various folks, many of whom, under duress, would participate in the army. Well, what about the agoge, the upbringing, which is really, in my view, probably the most distinctive thing about Sparta? And that is the process of education by which, after age 7, the children of Spartan citizens, with Mothakes and Trophimoi, perhaps, were raised over the course of 13 years to become full Spartan citizens, living together in barracks from the age of 7 in a group called the Agele, which was their age group. They also sometimes referred to these age groups as herds, and over them was a paidonimos, which was a boy herd. That was that they thought of it in terms of the language comes originally from cattle breeding, which is perhaps revealing and interesting. But even before that, even before you entered the agoge at age 7, you would have been selected. Fathers in Greece ordinarily, and for that matter, at least technically for a long time, fathers in Rome had the right of life and death over their children. And if elsewhere in Greece a child that didn't look likely to make it or a child that was unwanted was born, the custom was simply to expose the child. In other words, to avoid the pollution of killing the child, but just to take it out into a deserted area and there just leave it there and let it die. This is, by the way, what's lying behind the story of Oedipus being found by a shepherd and various other people being found by a shepherd. This was common currency, infanticide was part of the culture. What made Sparta different in that regard is that babies were bought, boy babies certainly, women babies or girl babies maybe, were bought before a group of elders who assessed the child and decided whether it was worth raising or should be put in the apothetai for getting land, so to speak, which was just a chasm in the Tagetos Mountains where they put unwanted babies to die. So after you'd passed that, you lived at home until you were seven, under training, by the way, of your helot nurse, and helot nurses were widely valued elsewhere in Greece. They seemed to have very good child control skills. It was part of the Spartan ethos that you should never be afraid of the dark or night terrors and all that. And if you wanted your child to get over such things, a helot nurse was a very good thing to have. Then at age seven, boom, you join the boy herd. Spend lots of time exercising. No lights at night ever. You would be given one garment a year, which you would wear winter and summer, no matter the temperature. You were barefoot all the time. Snow, too bad, still barefoot. You would go bathe in the Eurotas, which was cold, often, or not much of it, sometimes. And you would be fed not quite enough food. Enough to make you survive, but so that you were always hungry. This for two reasons. One, Sparta was as uninto being fat as the most arduous fashion hound in the contemporary world. You took a lot of flack if you were overweight. They did not like being overweight. They wanted you lean and mean and ready for action. They also thought it was a good idea not to feed people enough because they thought it helped to make good troops if you learned how to steal. And so boys were expected to steal regularly. However, if they were dumb enough to get caught, they beat the living daylights out of them. Because not so much because you were stealing, but because you were so dumb as to get caught. So you were stealing was simultaneously required and forbidden. There's a famous story, a ridiculous story in a way, although there's a key to it, about a boy who had stolen a fox cub. Why you would want to eat a fox cub, I don't know. But nevertheless, he had it under his cloak. He was being questioned, and the fox cub ate into his stomach and killed him, but he didn't cry out because, you know, the disgrace would be so great. I rather doubt that. I suspect it has something to do with the slang name for the guys in the Cryptea who were going off to live on their own out in the countryside. That was fox time when you had to live in the Cryptea. So who knows? Be that as it may, that is a famous story about that. For beds, they would go down to the Eurotas and cut reeds and then sleep on the reeds. And it was basically as rough as it could be. You were supposed to get used to heat, cold, deprivation, and so on, and become as tough as possible. The other things that they really emphasized, you did learn to read and write, though they didn't push that, but you learned it, you know, enough by Spartan standards, which is not lots, but enough. But you learned lots of inspiring Spartan poetry by memory. You learned how to dance. Dancing was a very big deal in Sparta. One reason that dancing was such a big deal, communal dancing, choral dancing, is it taught you to be constantly, habitually keyed in on what the people around you were doing. And if you were, your final job was to fight in a battle line, being used from childhood to keying in on the folks around you and to moving in unison was something that they really thought was a good idea. So they devoted a lot of time to dancing, a lot of time to training, a lot of time to singing, communal singing too, on the theory that that would bond people and also inspire them. Very, very strange. It was elaborately specified too. I have a list here of the various ages, the official age classes. You were a Pais from 7 to 11, a Robidas at 12, a Prokomizomos, a Prokomizomenos at 13, a Mikizomenos at 14, a Propais at 15, a Pais or a Hatropompais at 16, a Meliron at 17, and then you went into the Cryptea. And if you were lucky, you got to become a full Spartan citizen thereafter. At that point, you would be elected or not elected into one of the syssitia or messes. And these were buildings along the Hyacinthian Way between Sparta and Amyclae, the village about 5 miles away, which was part of Sparta, but not really in Sparta, which was where the Hyacinthia Festival was held. And these messes were small, and they were basically lifetime clubs. It's not unlike, it sounds to me not unlike a fraternity or an eating club at a old-fashioned school. You'd be vetted by one of these messes. And of course, there was a prestige hierarchy of messes, the ones that the kings belonged to being the top. And anybody who didn't want you in the mess could blackball you. One negative vote and you were out. And if nobody wanted you, and if you didn't get into any mess, you were not a citizen. Once you were in it basically for life. And the Spartans thought of that. These were not based on age group. They had people of all ages. And the idea was that the youngsters would be acculturated and learn from the old ones. And strangely enough, this all sounds horribly grim, but the testimony suggests that, in fact, the ordinary sort of emotional temperature of life among citizens, anyway, at Sparta was very cheerful. Lots of joking, lots of humor. You were expected to be able to take joking, and they thought of joking and teasing as a way to build character and show people what their flaws were. Although if you couldn't take it, you could get people to beg off. Of course, you lost status for doing that, but nevertheless, that evidently was the tune. The deal was that you had to be able to contribute your portion to the communal mess. And you were assigned or had your kleros, your allotment of helot farmed land in order to enable you to do that. And anything that you bought in from your hunting expeditions was a grace note and much appreciated and also enhanced your status, presumably. I should mention as well the notorious Spartan signature dish, which they ate a lot of and purported to relish and seemed to have enjoyed serving to visitors on the relatively rare occasions that they had them to demonstrate exactly how tough they were. It was supposed to be legendarily unpalatable unless you were Spartan. It was called black broth. And the recipe seems to have been, I have considered trying to make it just to see what it was like, but some of the ingredients aren't easy to come by. It was basically pork soup, vinegar-based, but with lots and lots of blood in it, which is what made it black. So it was like a sort of blood sausage soup with pork. And that was their signature dish. I mean, they ate bread and stuff, too, and various vegetables. But the centerpiece of Spartan cuisine was purportedly the legendary black broth. Well, a couple other small characteristics. We'll talk more about the position of women later on. Again, I mentioned before the frugality of Spartans, the ethos of deliberate unconsumption, of wearing one piece of clothing, period, for a whole year, that sort of thing. It is reminiscent of greens today. It is reminiscent, in a way, of monasticism. It wasn't until very late that the Spartans bothered to coin money at all. And at some point, instead of money, they used iron spits, or they used iron spits for money, which was by design monumentally inconvenient and designed as a discouragement to avarice. So when the Spartans finally found themselves in a position where they got money, they proved about as greedy as anybody else. Another thing very characteristic of Sparta, and according to Thucydides, they initiated this, is they were very into nudity. They exercised habitually, as ultimately all Greeks did, nude. Ordinarily, in most places in Greece, just men. The institutionalized pederasty here certainly was part of this package, though the nudity came, I suspect, before the pederasty, though I don't know that for a fact. But this was regarded as a kind of, you know, simplicity and nobility and so forth. So you wore as little as possible, or in many occasions, nothing. Uniquely, beyond that, in Sparta, adolescent girls also sometimes exercised publicly in the nude, and were encouraged in that state to mock out the guys who'd let themselves get a little bit flabby, who were in the 14 or 15-year-old boys' department, the idea being that that would be a real incentive for them to get their act together, which I don't doubt that it was.
This ends Lecture 3.